content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the New Yorker Archives, I will read an essay by James Baldwin. The first article that I will read today was published in the November 17, 1962 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I have edited it for length, and I have also updated some of the language to reflect the sensibilities of the 21st century. And now, from the November 17, 1962 issue of the New Yorker magazine, an excerpt from James Baldwin's Letter from a Region in My Mind. Whatever white people do not know about African Americans reveals precisely and inexorably what they do not know about themselves. Take up the white man's burden. Ye dare not stoop to less, nor call too loud on freedom to cloak your weariness. By all ye cry or whisper, by all ye leave or do, the silent, sullen peoples shall weigh your gods and you. Kipling. Down at the cross where my Savior died, down where for cleansing from sin I cried, there to my heart was the blood applied, singing glory to his name. A hymn. I underwent, during the summer that I became 14, a prolonged religious crisis. I use religious in the common and arbitrary sense, meaning that I then discovered God, his saints and angels, and his blazing hell. And since I had been born in a Christian nation, I accepted this deity as the only one. I supposed him to exist only within the walls of a church, in fact, of our church. And I also suppose that God and safety were synonymous. The word safety brings us to the real meaning of the word religious as we use it. Therefore, to state it in another, more accurate way, I became, during my 14th year, for the first time in my life, afraid. Afraid of the evil within me and afraid of the evil without. What I saw around me that summer in Harlem was what I had always seen. Nothing had changed. But now, without any warning, the whores and the pimps and the racketeers on the avenue had become a personal menace. It had not before occurred to me that I could become one of them. But now I realize that we have been produced by the same circumstances. Many of my comrades were clearly headed for the avenue. And my father said that I was headed that way too. My friends began to drink and smoke and embarked, at first avid and then groaning, on their sexual careers. Girls, only slightly older than I was, who sang in the choir or taught Sunday school, the children of holy parents, underwent, before my eyes, their incredible metamorphosis, of which the most bewildering aspect was not their budding breast or their rounding behinds, but something deeper and more subtle. In their eyes, their heat, their odor, and the inflection of their voices. Like the strangers on the avenue, they became, in the twinkling of an eye, unutterably different and fantastically present. Owing to the way I had been raised, the abrupt discomfort that all this aroused in me, and the fact that I had no idea what my voice or my mind or my body was likely to do next, caused me to consider myself one of the most depraved people on earth. Matters were not helped by the fact that these holy girls seemed rather to enjoy my terrified lapses, our grim, guilty, tormented experiments, which were at once as chill and joyless as the Russian steppes, and hotter by far than all the fires of hell. Yet there was something deeper than these changes, and less definable, that frightened me. It was real in both the boys and the girls, but it was somehow more vivid in the boys. In the case of the girls, one watched them turning into matrons before they had become women. They began to manifest a curious and really rather terrifying single-mindedness. It is hard to say exactly how this was conveyed. Something implacable in the set of the lips, something far-seeing in the eyes, some new and crushing determination in the walk, something peremptory in the voice. They did not tease us, the boys, anymore. They reprimanded us sharply, saying, "You better be thinking about your soul." For the girls also saw the evidence on the avenue, knew what the price would be for them of one misstep, knew that they had to be protected and that we were the only protection there was. They understood that they must act as God's decoys, saving the souls of the boys for Jesus and binding the bodies of the boys in marriage. For this was the beginning of our burning time. "And it is better," said St. Paul, who elsewhere, with a most unusual and stunning exactness, described himself as a wretched man. And I began to feel in the boys a curious, wary, bewildered despair, as though they were now settling in for the long, hard winter of life. I did not know then what it was that I was reacting to. I put it to myself that they were letting themselves go. In the same way that the girls were destined to gain as much weight as their mothers, the boys, it was clear, would rise no higher than their fathers. School began to reveal itself, therefore, as a child's game that one could not win. And boys dropped out of school and went to work. My father wanted me to do the same. I refused, even though I had no longer had any illusions about what an education could do for me. I had already encountered far too many college graduate handymen. My friends were now downtown, busy, as they put it, fighting the man. They began to care less about the way they looked, the way they dressed, the things they did. Presently, one found them in twos and threes and fours, in a hallway, sharing a jug of wine or a bottle of whiskey, talking, cursing, fighting, sometimes weeping, lost, and unable to say what it was that oppressed them, except they knew it was the man, the white man. And there seemed to be no way whatever to remove this cloud that stood between them and the sun, between them and love and life and power, between them and whatever it was they wanted. One did not have to be very bright to realize how little one could do to change one's situation. One did not have to be abnormally sensitive to be worn down to a cutting edge by the incessant and gratuitous humiliation and danger one encountered every working day, all day long. The humiliation did not apply merely to working days or workers. I was 13 and was crossing Fifth Avenue on my way to the 42nd Street Library, and a cop in the middle of the street muttered as I passed him, "Why don't you N-words stay uptown where you belong?" When I was 10 and didn't look certainly any older, two policemen amused themselves with me by frisking me, making comic and terrifying speculations concerning my ancestry and probable sexual prowess, and for good measure leaving me flat on my back in one of Harlem's empty lots. Just before and then during the Second World War, many of my friends fled into the service, all to be changed there, and rarely for the better. Many to be ruined, many to die. Others fled to other states and cities, that is, to other ghettos. Some went on wine or whiskey or the needle and are still on it, and others, like me, fled into the church. people more advantageously placed than we in Harlem were and are will no doubt find the psychology and the view of human nature sketched above dismal and shocking in the extreme. But the African American's experience of the white world cannot possibly create in him any respect for the standards by which the white world claims to live. His own condition is overwhelming proof that white people do not live by these standards. African American servants have been smuggling odds and ends out of white homes for generations, and white people have been delighted to have them do it, because it has assuaged a dim guilt and testified to the intrinsic superiority of white people. Even the most doltish and servile African American could scarcely fail to be impressed by the disparity between his situation and that of the people for whom he worked. African Americans who were neither doltish nor servile did not feel that they were doing anything wrong when they robbed white people. In spite of the Puritan Yankee equation of virtue with well-being, African Americans had excellent reasons for doubting that money was made or kept by any very striking adherence to the Christian virtues. It certainly did not work that way for black Christians. In any case, white people who had robbed black people of their liberty and who profited by this theft every hour that they lived had no moral ground on which to stand. They had the judges, the juries, the shotguns, the law, in a word, power. But it was criminal power, to be feared but not respected, and to be outwitted in any way whatever. And these virtues, preached but not practiced by the white world, were merely another means of holding blacks in subjection. It is certainly sad that the awakening of one's senses should lead to such a merciless judgment of oneself, to say nothing of the time and anguish one spends in the effort to arrive at any other. But it is also inevitable that a literal attempt to mortify the flesh should be made among black people like those with whom I grew up. African Americans in this country, and African Americans do not, strictly or legally speaking, exist in any other, are taught really to despise themselves from the moment their eyes open on the world. The world is white, and they are black. White people hold the power, which means that they are superior to blacks. Intrinsically, that is, God decreed it so. And the world has innumerable ways of making this difference known and felt and feared. Long before the African-American child perceives this difference, and even longer before he understands it, he has begun to react to it. He has begun to be controlled by it. Every effort made by the child's elders to prepare him for a fate from which they cannot protect him causes him secretly, in terror, to begin to await, without knowing that he is doing so, his mysterious and inexorable punishment. He must be good not only to please his parents and not only to avoid being punished by them. Behind the authority stands another, nameless and impersonal, infinitely harder to please, and bottomlessly cruel. And this filters into the child's consciousness through his parents' tone of voice as he is being exhorted, punished, or loved, in the sudden uncontrollable note of fear heard in his mother's or his father's voice when he has strayed beyond some particular boundary. He does not know what the boundary is, and he can get no explanation of it, which is frightening enough. But the fear he hears in the voices of his elders is more frightening still. The fear that I heard in my father's voice, for example, when he realized that I really believed that I could do anything a white boy could do and had every intention of proving it. It was not at all like the fear I heard when one of us was ill, or had fallen down the stairs, or strayed too far from the house. It was another fear, a fear that the child, in challenging the white world's assumptions, was putting himself in the path of destruction. a child cannot, thank heaven, know how vast and how merciless is the nature of power. With what unbelievable cruelty people treat each other. He reacts to the fear in his parents' voices because his parents hold up the world for him and he has no protection without them. I defended myself, as I imagined, against the fear of my father, made me feel by remembering that he was very old-fashioned. Also, I prided myself on the fact that I already knew how to outwit him. To defend oneself against a fear is simply to ensure that one will, one day, be conquered by it. Fears must be faced. As for one's wits, it is just not true that one can live by them. Not, that is, if one wishes really to live. That summer, in any case, all the fears which I had grown up with, and which were now a part of me and controlled my vision of the world, rose up like a wall between the world and me and drove me into the church. The white man's heaven, sings a black Muslim minister, is the black man's hell. One may object, possibly, that this puts the matter somewhat too simply, but the song is true, and it has been true for as long as white men have ruled the world. The Africans put it another way. When the white man came to Africa, the white man had the Bible and the African had the land. But now it is the white man who is being reluctantly and bloodily separated from the land, and the African who is still attempting to digest or to vomit up the Bible. The struggle, therefore, that now begins in the world is extremely complex, involving the historical role of Christianity in the realm of power, that is, politics, and in the realm of morals. In the realm of power, Christianity has operated with an unmitigated arrogance and cruelty. Necessarily, since a religion ordinarily imposes on those who have discovered the truth faith, the spiritual duty of liberating the infidels. This particular true faith, moreover, is more deeply concerned about the soul than it is about the body, to which fact the flesh and the corpses of countless infidels bears witnesses. It goes without saying, then, that whoever questions the authority of the true faith also contests the right of the nations that hold this faith to rule over him. Contest, in short, their title to his land. The spreading of the gospel, regardless of the motives or the integrity or the heroism of some of the missionaries, was an absolutely indispensable justification for the planting of the flag. Priests, nuns, and school teachers helped to protect and sanctify the power that was so ruthlessly being used by people who were indeed seeking a city, but not one in the heavens, and one to be made very definitely by captive hands. The Christian church itself, again as distinguished from some of its ministers, sanctified and rejoiced in the conquest of the flag, and encouraged, if it did not formulate, the belief that conquest, with the resulting relative well-being of the Western populations, was proof of the favor of God. God had come a long way from the desert, but then so had Allah. Though in very different direction. God going north and rising on the wings of power had become white, and Allah out of power and on the dark side of heaven had become, for all practical purposes anyway, black. Thus, in the realm of morals, the role of Christianity has been, at best, ambivalent. Even leaving out of account the remarkable arrogance that assumed that the ways and morals of others were inferior to those of Christians, and that they therefore had every right and could use any means to change them, the collision between cultures, and the schizophrenia in the mind of Christendom had rendered the domain of morals as chartless as the sea once was, and as treacherous as the sea still is. It is not too much to say that whoever wishes to become a truly moral human being, and let us not ask whether or not this is possible, I think we must believe that it is possible, must first divorce himself from all the prohibitions, crimes, and hypocrisies of the Christian church. If the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only be to make us larger, freeing, and more loving. If God cannot do this, then it is time we got rid of him. The treatment accorded the African Americans during the Second World War marks for me a turning point in the African Americans' relation to America. To put it briefly and somewhat too simply, a certain hope died. A certain respect for white Americans faded. One began to pity them or to hate them. You must put yourself in the skin of a man who is wearing the uniform of his country, is a candidate for death in its defense, and who is called a N-word by his comrades in arms and his officers, who is almost always given the hardest, ugliest, most menial work to do, who knows that the white GI has informed the Europeans that he is subhuman. So much for the American male's sexual security, who does not dance at the USO, the white night white soldiers dance there, and who does not drink in the same bars white soldiers drink in, and who watches German prisoners of war being treated by Americans with more human dignity than he has ever received at their hands, and who, at the same time, as a human being, is far freer in a strange land than he has ever been at home. Home! The very word begins to have a despairing and diabolical ring. You must consider what happens to this citizen after all he has endured and when he returns home. Starch in his shoes for a job, for a place to live, ride in his skin on segregated buses, see with his eyes the signs saying white and colored, and especially the signs that say white ladies and colored women. Look into the eyes of his wife. Look into the eyes of his son. Listen with his ears to political speeches, North and South. Imagine yourself being told to wait. And all this is happening in the richest and freest country in the world. And in the middle of the 20th century, the subtle and deadly change of heart that might occur in you would be involved with the realization that a civilization is not destroyed by wicked people. It is not necessary that people be wicked, but only that they be spineless. I and two black acquaintances, all of us well past 30, and looking it, were in the bar of Chicago's O'Hare Airport several months ago. And the bartender refused to serve us because he said we looked too young. It took a vast amount of patience not to strangle him, and great insistence and some luck to get the manager, who defended his bartender on the ground that he was new and had not yet presumably learned how to distinguish between an African-American boy of 20 and an African-American boy of 37. Well, we were served finally, of course, but by this time, no amount of scotch would have helped us. The bar was very crowded, and our altercation had become extremely noisy. Not one customer in the bar had done anything to help us. When it was over, and the three of us stood at the bar trembling with rage and frustration and drinking, and trapped now in the airport, for we had deliberately come early in order to have a few drinks and to eat. A young white man standing near us asked if we were students. I suppose he thought that this was the only possible explanation for our putting up a fight. I told him that he didn't want to talk to us earlier and that we didn't want to talk to him now. The reply visibly hurt his feelings, and this in turn caused me to despise him. But when one of us, a Korean War veteran, told this young man that the fight we had been having in the bar had been his fight, too, the young man said, "I lost my conscience a long time ago," and turned and walked out. I know that one would rather not think so, but this young man is typical. So, on the basis of the evidence, and everyone had everyone else in the bar lost his conscience. A few years ago, I would have hated these people with all my heart. Now, I pity them. Pity them in order not to despise them. And this is not the happiest way to feel toward one's countrymen. But in the end, it is the threat of universal extinction hanging over all the world today that changes totally and forever the nature of reality and brings into devastating question the true meaning of man's history. We human beings now have the power to exterminate ourselves. This seems to be the entire sum of our achievement. We have taken this journey and arrived at this place in God's name. This, then, is the best that God, the white God, can do. If that is so, then it is time to replace him. Replace him with what? And this void, this despair, this torment is felt everywhere in the West, from the streets of Stockholm to the churches of New Orleans and the sidewalks of Harlem. The glorification of one race and the consequent debasement of another or others always has been and always will be a recipe for murder. There is no way around this. If one is permitted to treat any group of people with special disfavor because of their race or the color of their skin, there is no limit to what one will force them to endure. And since the entire race has been mysteriously indicted, no reason not to attempt to destroy it root and branch. This is precisely what the Nazis attempted. Their only originality lay in the means they used. It is scarcely worthwhile to attempt remembering how many times the sun has looked down on the slaughter of the innocents. I am very much concerned that African Americans achieve their freedom here in the United States. But I am also concerned for their dignity, for the health of their souls, and must oppose any attempt that African Americans may make to do to others what has been done to them. I think I know. We see it around us every day. The spiritual wasteland to which that road leads. It is so simple a fact that one that is so hard, apparently, to grasp. Whoever debases others is debasing himself. Whoever debases others is debasing himself. That is not a mystical statement, but a most realistic one, which is proved by the eyes of any Alabama sheriff. And I would not like to see African Americans ever arrived at so wretched a condition. Now, it is extremely unlikely that African Americans will ever rise to power in the United States, because they are only approximately a ninth of this nation. They are not in the position of the Africans who are attempting to reclaim their land and break the colonial yoke and recover from the colonial experience. The African American situation is dangerous in a different way, both for the black, qua black, and for the country for which he forms so troubled and troubling a part. The African American is a unique creation. He has no counterpart anywhere, and no predecessors. The Muslims react to this fact by referring to the African American as the so-called American, and substituting for the names inherited from the slavery the letter X. It is a fact that every African American hears a name that originally belonged to the white man whose chattel he was. I am called Baldwin because I was either sold by my African tribe or kidnapped out of it into the hands of a white Christian named Baldwin, who forced me to kneel at the foot of the cross. I am, then, both visibly and legally, the descendants of slaves in a white Protestant country, and this is what it means to be an African American. this who he is, a kidnapped pagan who was sold like an animal and treated like one, who was once defined by the American Constitution as three-fifths of a man, and who, according to the Dred Scott decision, had no rights that a white man was bound to respect. And today, 100 years after his technical emancipation, he remains, with the possible exception of the American Indian, the most despised creature in his country. Now, there is simply no possibility of a real change in the African-American situation without the most radical and far-reaching changes in the American political and social structure. And it is clear that white Americans are not simply unwilling to effect these changes. They are, in the main, so slothful have they become, unable even to envision them. It must be added that the Negro himself no longer believes in the good faith of white Americans, if indeed he ever could have. What the African American has discovered, and on an international level, is that the power to intimidate, which he has always had privately, but hitherto could manipulate only privately, for private ends often, for limited ends always. And therefore, when the country speaks of a new African American, which it has been doing every hour on the hour for decades, it is not really referring to a change in the African American, which in any case it is quite incapable of assessing, but only to a new difficulty in keeping him in his place, to the fact that it encounters him again and again, barring yet another door to its spiritual and social ease. This is probably hard and odd as it may sound, the most important thing that one human being can do for another. It is certainly one of the most important things. Hence, the torment and necessity of love. And this is the enormous contribution that the African American has made to this otherwise shapeless and undiscovered country. Consequently, white Americans are in nothing more deluded than in supposing that African Americans could ever have imagined that white people would give them anything. It is rare indeed that people give. Most people guard and keep. They suppose that it is they themselves and what they identify with themselves that they are guarding and keeping. Whereas what they are actually guarding and keeping is their system of reality and what they assume themselves to be. One can give nothing whatever without giving oneself. That is to say, risking oneself. If one cannot risk oneself, then one is simply incapable of giving. And, after all, one can give freedom only by setting someone free. This is in the case of the African American, the American Republic has never become sufficiently mature to do. White Americans have contented themselves with gestures that are now described as tokenism. For a hard example, white Americans congratulate themselves on the 1954 Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the schools. They suppose, in spite of the mountain of evidence that has since accumulated to the contrary, that this was a proof of change of heart, or, as they like to say, progress. Perhaps. It all depends on how one reads the word progress. Most of the African Americans I know do not believe that this immense concession would ever have been made if it had not been for the competition of the Cold War and the fact that Africa was clearly liberating herself and therefore had, for political reasons, to be wooed by the descendants of her former masters. Had it been a matter of love or justice, the 1954 decision would surely have occurred sooner. Were it not for the realities of power in this difficult era, it might very well not have occurred yet. This seems an extremely harsh way of stating the case, ungrateful as it were. But the evidence that supports this way of stating it is not easily refuted. I myself do not think that it can be refuted at all. In any event, the sloppy and fatuous nature of American goodwill can never be relied upon to deal with hard problems. These have been dealt with, when they have been dealt with at all, out of necessity. And in political terms, anyway, necessity means concessions made in order to stay on top. I think this is a fact, which it serves no purpose to deny. But whether it is a fact or not, this is what the black populations of the world, including black Americans, really believe. The word independence in Africa and the word integration here are almost equally meaningless. That is, Europe has not yet left Africa, and black men here are not yet free. And both of these last statements are undeniable facts, related facts, containing the gravest implications for us all. The African Americans may never be able to rise to power, but they are very well placed to precipitate chaos and ring down the curtain on the American dream. This has everything to do, of course, with the nature of that dream and with the fact that we Americans, of whatever color, do not dare examine it and are far from having made it a reality. There are too many things we do not wish to know about ourselves. People are not, for example, terribly anxious to be equal. Equal, after all, to what and to whom? But they love the idea of being superior. And this human truth has an especially grinding force here, where identity is almost impossible to achieve, and people are perpetually attempting to find their feet on the shifting sands of status. Consider the history of labor in a country in which, spiritually speaking, there are no workers, only candidates for the hand of the boss's daughter. Furthermore, I have met only a very few people, and most of these were not Americans, who had any real desire to be free. Freedom is hard to bear. It can be objected that I am speaking of political freedom in spiritual terms. But the political institutions of any nation are always menaced and are ultimately controlled by the spiritual state of that nation. We are controlled here by our confusion, far more than we know. And the American dream has therefore become something much more closely resembling a nightmare on the private, domestic, and international levels. Privately, we cannot stand our lives and dare not examine them. Domestically, we take no responsibility for and no pride in what goes on in our country. And internationally, for millions of people, we are an unmitigated disaster. Behind what we think of as the Russian menace lies what we do not wish to face, and what white Americans do not face when they regard an African American. Reality. The fact that life is tragic. Life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun inexorably rises and sets, and one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives. We'll imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have. It seems to me that one ought to rejoice in the fact of death. Ought to decide, indeed, to earn one's death by confronting with passion the conundrum of life. One is responsible to life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we shall return. One must negotiate this passage as nobly as possible for the sake of those who are coming after us. But white Americans do not believe in death. And that is why the darkness of my skin so intimidates them. And this is also why the presence of the African American can bring about its destruction. It is the responsibility of free men to trust and to celebrate what is constant. Birth, struggle, and death are constant. And so is love, though we may not always think so. and to apprehend the nature of change, to be able and willing to change. I speak of change not on the surface, but in the depth. Change in the sense of renewal. But renewal becomes impossible if one supposes things to be constant that are not. Safety, for example, or money or power. One clings then to chimeras by which one can only be betrayed, and the entire hope, the entire possibility of freedom disappears. And by destruction, I mean precisely the abdication by Americans of any effort really to be free. The African American can precipitate this abdication because white Americans have never, in all their long history, been able to look on him as a man like themselves. The point need not be labored. It is proved over and over again by the African American's continuing position here and his indescribable structure to defeat the stratagems that white Americans have used and use to deny him his humanity. America could have used in other ways the energy that both groups have expended in this conflict. America, of all the Western nations, has been best placed to prove the uselessness and the obsolescence of the concept of color. But it has not dared to accept this opportunity, or even to conceive of it as an opportunity. White Americans have thought of it as their shame, and have envied those more civilized and elegant European nations that were untroubled by the presence of black men on their shores. This is because white Americans have supposed Europe and civilization to be synonymous, to be synonyms, which they are not, and have been distrustful of other standards and other sources of vitality, especially those produced in America itself, and have attempted to behave in all matters as though what was East for Europe was also East for them. What it comes to is that if we, who can scarcely be considered a white nation, persist in thinking of ourselves as one, we condemn ourselves with the truly white nations to sterility and decay. Whereas if we could accept ourselves as we are, we might bring new life to the Western achievements and transform them. The price of this transformation is the unconditional freedom of the African American. It is not too much to say that he, who has been so long rejected, must now be embraced, and at no matter what psychic or social risk, he is the key figure in his country. And the American future is precisely as bright or as dark as his. And the African American recognizes this in a negative way. Hence the question, do I really want to be integrated into a burning house? White Americans find it as difficult as white people elsewhere to do to divest themselves of the notion that they are in possession of some intrinsic value that black people need or want. And this assumption, which, for example, makes the solution of the African American problem depend on the speed with which African Americans accept and adopt white standards, is revealed in all kinds of striking ways. From Bobby Kennedy's assurance that an African American can become president in 40 years, to the unfortunate tone of warm congratulation with which so many liberals address their African American equals. It is the African American, of course, who is presumed to have become equal, an achievement that not only proves the comforting fact that perseverance has no color, but also overwhelmingly corroborates the white man's sense of his own value. Alas, this value can scarcely be corroborated in any other way. There is certainly little enough in the white man's public or private life that one should desire to imitate. White men at the bottom of their hearts know this. Therefore, a vast amount of the energy that goes into what we call the African American problem is produced by the white man's profound desire not to be judged by those who are not white, not to be seen as he is, And at the same time, a vast amount of the white's anguish is rooted in the white man's equally profound need to be seen as he is, to be released from the tyranny of his mirror. All of us know, whether or not we are able to admit it, that mirrors can only lie, that death by drowning is all that awaits one there. It is for this reason that love is so desperately sought and so cunningly avoided. Love takes off the mask that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within. I use the word love here, not merely in the personal sense, but as a state of being or a state of grace, not in the infantile American sense of being happy, but in the tough and universal sense of quest and daring and growth. And I submit, then, that the racial tensions that menace Americans today have little to do with real antipathy. On the contrary, indeed, and are involved with only symbolically with color. These tensions are rooted in the very same depths as those from which love springs, or murder. The white man's unadmitted, and apparently to him unspeakable, private fears and longings are projected onto the African American. The only way he can be released from the African American's tyrannical power over him is to consent, in effect, to become black himself, become a part of that suffering and dancing country that he now watches wistfully from the heights of his lonely power and, armed with spiritual traveler's checks, visits surreptitiously after dark. How can one respect, let alone adopt, the value of a people who do not, and on any level whatever, live the way they say they do, or the way they say they should? I cannot accept the proposition that the 400-year travail of the African American should result merely in his attainment of the present level of the American civilization. I am far from convinced that being released from the African witch doctor was worthwhile if I am now, in order to support the moral contradictions and the spiritual aridity of my life, expected to become dependent on the American psychiatrist. It is a bargain I refuse. The only thing white people have that black people need or should want is power. And no one holds power forever. White people cannot, in the generality, be taken as models of how to live. Rather, the white man is himself in sore need of new standards, which will release him from his confusion and place him once again in fruitful communion with the depths of his own being. And I repeat, the price of the liberation of the white people is the liberation of the blacks, the total liberation in the cities, in the towns, before the law, and in the mind. Why, for example, especially knowing the family as I do, why should I want to marry your sister is a great mystery to me. But your sister and I have every right to marry if we wish to, and no one has the right to stop us. If she cannot raise me to her level, perhaps I can raise her to mine. In short, we, the black and the white, deeply need each other if we are really to become a nation. If we are really, that is, to achieve our identity, our maturity as men and women. To create one nation has proved to be a hideously difficult task. There is certainly no need now to create two, one black and one white. But white men with far more political power than that possessed by the Nation of Islam movement have been advocating exactly this, in effect, for generations. If this sentiment is honored when it falls from the lips of Senator Byrd, then there is no reason it should not be honored when it falls from the lips of Malcolm X. And any congressional committee wishing to investigate the latter must also be willing to investigate the former. they are expressing exactly the same sentiments and represent exactly the same danger. There is absolutely no reason to suppose that white people are better equipped to frame the laws by which I am to be governed than I am. It is entirely unacceptable that I should have no voice in the political affairs of my country, for I am not a ward of America. I am one of the first Americans to arrive on these shores. This passed. The African Americans passed of rope, fire, torture, castration, infanticide, rape, death, and humiliation. Fear by day and night, fear as deep as the marrow of the bone, doubt that he was worthy of life, since everyone around him denied it, sorrow for his women, for his kinfolk, for his children, who needed his protection and whom he could not protect, rage, hatred, and murder, hatred for white men so deep that it often turned against him and his own and made all love and trust and all joy impossible. This past, this endless struggle to achieve and reveal and confirm a human identity, human authority, yet contains for all its horror something very beautiful. I do not mean to be sentimental about suffering. Enough is certainly as good as a feast. But people who cannot suffer can never grow up, can never discover who they are. The man who is forced each day to snatch his manhood, his identity, out of the fire of human cruelty that rages to destroy it knows, if he survives his effort, and even if he does not survive it, something about himself and human life that no school on earth, and indeed no church, can teach. He achieves his own authority, and that is unshakable. This is because in order to save his life, he is forced to look beneath appearances, to take nothing for granted, to hear the meaning behind the words. If one is continually surviving the worst that life can bring, one eventually ceases to be controlled by a fear of what life can bring. Whatever it brings must be borne. And at this level of experience, one's bitterness begins to be palatable, and hatred becomes too heavy a sack to carry. The apprehension of life here so briefly and inadequately sketched has been the experience of generations of African Americans, and it helps to explain how they have endured and how they have been able to produce children of kindergarten age who can walk through mobs to get to school. It demands great force and great cunning continually to assault the mighty and indifferent fortress of white supremacy, as African Americans in this country have done so long. It demands great spiritual resilience not to hate the hater whose foot is on your neck, and an even greater miracle of perception and charity not to teach your children to hate. The African American boys and girls who are facing mobs today come out of a long line of improbable aristocrats, the only genuine aristocrats this country has produced. I say this country because their frame of reference was totally American. They were hewing out of the mountain of white supremacy the stone of their individuality. I have great respect for that unsung army of black men and women who trudged down back lanes and entered back doors saying, "Yes, sir," and "No, ma'am," in order to acquire a new roof for the schoolhouse, new books, a new chemistry lab, more beds for the dormitories, and more dormitories. They did not like saying yes, sir, and no, ma'am, but the country was in no hurry to educate African Americans. These black men and women knew that the job had to be done, and they put their pride in their pockets in order to do it. It is very hard to believe that they were in any way inferior to the white men and women who opened those black back doors. It is very hard to believe that these men and women, raising their children, eating their greens, crying their curses, weeping their tears, singing their songs, making their love as the sun rose, as the sun set, were in any way inferior to the white men and women who crept over to share these splendors after the sun went down. We must not suppose that because the situation, the ways, the perceptions of black people so radically differ from those of whites, that they were racially superior. I am proud of these people, not because of their color, but because of their intelligence and their spiritual force and their beauty. The country should be proud of them too, But alas, not many people in this country even know of their existence. And the reason for this ignorance is that a knowledge of the role these people played and play in American life would reveal more about America to Americans than Americans wish to know. A bill is coming in that I fear America is not prepared to pay. The problem of the 20th century, wrote W.E.B. Du Bois around 60 years ago, is the problem of the color line. A fearful and delicate problem which compromises, when it does not corrupt, all the American efforts to build a better world, here, there, or anywhere. It is for this reason that everything white Americans think they believe in must now be reexamined. What one would not like to see again is the consolidation of peoples on the basis of their color. But as long as we in the West place on color the value that we do, we make it impossible for the great unwashed to consolidate themselves according to any other principle. Color is not a human or personal reality. It is a political reality. But this is a distinction so extremely hard to make that the West has not been able to make it yet. And at the center of this dreadful storm, this vast confusion, stand the black people of this nation, who must now share the fate of a nation that has never accepted them, to which they were brought in chains. Well, if this is so, one has no choice but to do all in one's power to change the fate, and at no matter what risk, eviction, imprisonment, torture, death, for the sake of one's children, in order to minimize the bill that they must pay, one must be careful not to take refuge in any delusions. And the value placed on the color of the skin is always and everywhere and forever a delusion. I know that what I am asking is impossible, but in our time, as in every time, the impossible is the least that one can demand. And one is, after all, emboldened by the spectacle of human history in general, and African American history in particular, for it testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading to it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Or send me an email to info@ncreadingservice.org. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, so long, everybody.